Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Mark, it's great to be with you.
Good to see you once again and continuing our discussion of the most common questions in estate planning. Kind of left off last week with the big subject of probate and
right.
How to avoid that. Does a will accomplish that? And you kind of touched a little bit on why don't I just get my kids or someone else signed on to my documents, and you kind of want to explore some problems with that this time.
Yeah, so we're talking about estate planning, and last show we talked about the main documents that everybody needs. So why do I need estate planning just as a general statement, and can I do it myself? So all those were touched upon last week. You can go to legacyandfaith.com and tune into that last podcast. They're all up there. But look, every person needs, regardless of age, everyone needs at least four major documents to support their life and their death. So the first issue is that oftentimes when we talk about estate planning, we miss the necessity of having good documents to support that I might encounter a disability or a time in my life when I need someone to support me. Estate planning creates good documents to make the person who is going to assist you in a health emergency or other needs in life, make their experience as smooth as possible. So estate planning should create a smooth transition of power and authority over your assets and over your health care needs should you need them during your lifetime. And then that should be also the same goal should you pass away. So your turn to go see Jesus face to face, that'll be a glorious day for you. But there's work to be done should you leave this earth. And people intuitively know that, oh yeah, if I die, there's got to be a few things to clean up. Okay, yes, there are. And there's actually more work that needs to be done than what most people believe. And so we need good documents to support that transition as well. And so everyone needs a will or a trust. Those documents then support what happens should you pass away. However, a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney, and an end-of-life document called a living will need to be created in order to have all, you taken care of as a person should you need assistance at any time during your life. So all of these documents are critical and important. And so therefore, what people try to do is think up of ways that says, well, if I don't spend the money on getting a will or a power of attorney, or that process is intimidating, or I just don't have that much money, so can't I just bring someone else onto my accounts? And of course, that's where the question started. It's amazing how long I can talk before I get to the question. So, but I get there, don't I, Mark? Mm. So what if I just avoid doing estate planning and I simply bring my kids onto my checking account, or I pull them on and I quickly claim my house to them? These are great ideas, Paul. So explore that with me. Okay, let's explore that great idea. So this is a common story that I communicate. I was in my early part of my career. I was actually living in Michigan. I went to law school in Michigan. And then I spent the first couple of years practicing in Michigan before I moved back home. This is home. Both my wife's parents and my entire family were in the Pacific Northwest. So it was kind of natural that we would gravitate back to here. But in Michigan, I was I had a case, and I was in the halls of the courtroom, and a conversation intrigued me. So I stopped. So yes, I was eavesdropping, and it was between an attorney and a client. Maybe she was in her upper 60s, maybe young 70s. I hesitate to say that's old because then I might offend somebody. But nonetheless, she was in that age group, and the conversation went something like this, which is, "But that was my money," and the attorney's response was, "Yes, but your daughter was on the account." And the client's response was, but that was my money. That was my Social Security check. And the attorney's response, yes, but when you brought your daughter onto the checking account and she was sued, that gave them the right to come and garnish your account because you gave the authority over to your daughter. Mm. Now, in this storyline, I want you to hear a couple things. Number one, daughter wasn't being bad towards mom. Okay? So daughter was not being nefarious. She wasn't stealing. Now, that is a possibility, yeah. And you got to make sure that you're careful bringing them on. Look, people bring their children onto accounts and then their children steal from them. And there must have been a thought process in that person's mind when they brought their child on. This is a good, Johnny won't steal from me. And yet Johnny does. And so be careful. Yes, I know you love your kids and we are designed to see all the good things in our children or in your neighbor or in your best friend or in whoever else you're going to bring onto your accounts. We are designed to see the good in them and forgive their weaknesses. So be careful because you could be taken advantage of. The relationship may not be exactly what you see it to be. And as we age, we understand that those that ability to fight off and perceive things properly weakens and weakens. This is just the reality of it. And so therefore, when you're making this decision inside of a bubble, that could be a danger sign for you. Have those bells and whistles going off. Get counsel. So daughter in my story was not being a bad daughter. She wasn't ripping mom off, but she ran into some sort of a financial issue. I don't know what it was. I don't know if she forgot to pay a credit card or if she was in a bad car accident and someone sued her. I don't know the circumstance. But what I do know is that she was sued and then someone garnished the account because she was on the account. Mm. So that whole story says that the liabilities of the person you bring on may become your liabilities if you have them on the account. And why would you take that type of a danger? Oh, my Johnny is good. He manages his money good. He works. His marriage is great. Okay, fine. But he could make a driving error. He could plow into somebody and make a simple driving error and we could have a problem. And now his liability, even though he's a good boy, could be at your doorstep. Why take that risk? Why not do really good estate planning, which can alleviate that risk? Why not do wise things instead of dueling the cheap way out or the version that you think works? Or that's what my parents did. My parents added me to the bank account and to the house. And look, I had no problems. Okay, fine. I'm glad that worked, but that's not real. That's not good estate planning. So we need to do good estate planning instead of trying to use Band-Aids or duct tape and make up how we are going to do this journey. Mm. So there are dangers inherent with possibly bringing somebody on. And I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer. I'm sorry if your name is Debbie. I'm not trying to be that. I am just trying to warn you that there are things we need to think about before taking that action. There's things that we can do better and with better wisdom that will protect you and your estate versus just simply signing over accounts or signing over the house. So here's one last thing, and then maybe we can move on, which is, because I've heard this so many times. Well, what if I just bring my kids onto the house? Because then when I die, they're joint owners. Remember, that's a way to avoid probate. There's a couple ways you can avoid the probate process. You can have a joint ownership or you can have a beneficiary designation on an asset. Both of those are probate runarounds. So that's fine. I'm going to bring my kid onto the house. But what you did is you gave your kid a gift. So let's say you have a $500,000 home and there's no mortgage on it and you have two kids, you want to treat them equally. So you bring both of them onto it. I should have used 600. It's worth 600 because then I can do the math in my head instead of getting my calculator out. And what you did is you gave each of your children a $200,000 gift. Why? Because you own half of it and you brought two more people on. So did you file a gift tax return that year? Probably not, because you don't have wisdom to talk through what does it mean in your overall estate plan to make sure that this is done right. And not only that, but after you've passed away, they took your home, that gift, with your basis. So now they missed a step up. And so now they have a tax consequence. They go and sell the home, and they come, and lo and behold, they have to pay a tax on the sale of that home, when if we had done proper estate planning, they could have actually gotten the proceeds, most likely, not every time, but most likely, without any tax whatsoever. But because you didn't get wisdom at the beginning and you brought your kids onto the house, now you created two potential tax problems. You didn't file a tax return like you were supposed to when you gave the gift. And now there's a capital gains issue that we could have gotten the house to your children with no taxes involved, because that's the way estate planning works when it's done well. But we need to talk through these issues. In other words, what is your main goal? Why did you do that? Get wisdom. Okay? Proverbs is full and repetitively says, get wisdom. Get wisdom, get wisdom. And so we need wisdom from other people instead of just doing what mom and dad did or doing other things. So there's potential dangers when we are starting to turn over assets or bring people onto our accounts, because it will be easy. I'm using air quotes, but you can't see me because we're on radio, but easy. Well, what is going to be easy about that if indeed that person who's helping you runs into a problem? Or what is going to be easy when they get slapped with a tax on the back end that they didn't anticipate? What will be easy about one person being on your bank account with all of your money and them legally having the right, or because they're a joint owner, that legally becomes their asset and they don't have to share it? Oh, but little Johnny will. Okay, I've seen it that he doesn't. And so, if he is morally obligated to share it and follows that because he really is being a good kid, then we've produced a potential gift tax to him. So there's so many multiple threads of problems that we just need to talk through. Look, my job is to advise you. It's not to control you. So if you ultimately want to bring little Johnny onto your house, I'll help you with that, but let's talk through wisdom to make sure that you have all of the perspective you need to make that decision instead of actually doing proper estate planning. So we need to do proper estate planning. We need wisdom to see the full picture.
Okay, looking at some of the common questions in estate planning with Paul Grant, and you're enjoying his wisdom today, and you'd like to know more, maybe how he can help you with your estate planning. How do people get in touch with you, Paul?
Yeah, let's get together. Let's start the process. Head over to legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts. There's educational opportunities coming up, ways to communicate with us. So head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com.
Okay, back with more common questions in estate planning with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. Hosea 4:6 says, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." God's people need to be fully prepared in managing their finances and ensuring that their wealth is properly transferred. It is our passion to bring this knowledge to the body of Christ. If your church would benefit from having a financial and estate session that is biblically based, then I encourage you to reach out to us so that we can help design and implement a specific and strategic session for your church. Or if you are interested in estate planning services, then I likewise encourage you to reach out to us. You can go to legacyandfaith.com and receive all the information you need. Again, go to legacyandfaith.com.
Many families realize that with the passing of each generation, their family legacy is disappearing and they're feeling regret. To alleviate this heartache, Memories Worth Telling writes their family story and creates a beautiful heirloom book to preserve their unique history. Go to memorieswordtelling.com to schedule your initial consultation and learn how they can capture your legacy. Once again, that's memorieswordtelling.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, Legacy and Faith Show this week, Paul tackling some of the most common questions in estate planning, and on to another question. I have a living will. Do I need anything else? Well, Now, I've heard of living trust and a will, but what's a living will?
Yeah, so a living will is really your end-of-life document. It's just a different terminology that attorneys use. But I've had a lot of clients walk in and say, well, I have a living will, so is that good enough? And really what they mean is possibly a living trust or possibly a will, and they start confusing all of the different terminologies together. Mm. So let me just review. We need four major documents. We need a will or a trust. That's the disposition, and actually a revocable living trust, which we're going to get into next, that has living instructions and death instructions. You need a financial power of attorney. You need a healthcare power of attorney. And you need an end-of-life document. And that's the one that oftentimes, as a matter of fact, even my documents, I think, say living will. Why is it? Because you're still alive. And so now what are we going to do to possibly remove you from life support? And what are the things, what are the decisions to go ahead and allow your body to naturally do what it's going to do? I'm not exactly sure the history on this terminology of living will, but that's really what a living will is. It's your end-of-life document. It's an important document. It needs to be discussed, and there are very critical decisions within that document. But the living will is a separate document, and it's just one of the four that every person needs.
Are these things that a doctor or medical facility are going to ask to be produced? Is this something you carry around with you in your wallet or you have on your phone? Or
yeah, good question.
How do you produce these?
Hospitals do want information about your decisions, your medical power of attorney, your end-of-life documents. Hospitals are very, very pushy. Medical community pushes a pulse. It's a physician's order of life-sustaining treatment. And that document is really intended to protect the doctor instead of protect the client. So in my opinion, from the legal side, those are very different documents. They function very differently. One is to alleviate the medical community. The other one, the living will, the end-of-life document that attorneys put together, are intended to be your voice in that specific situation. And so, when you do estate planning, hopefully your estate planning attorney advised you, go ahead and get this into your doctor so they can scan it in. Most of our medical community they're able to transfer documents from one hospital to another. There's a few outliers with that, but a lot of them are able to see medical documents. So getting it scanned into your permanent medical records may be a very good thing. And then there are some companies that actually assist and help scan those things up so that if you entered into the hospital, that they would be on call and they would fax over your documents in an emergency situation. Mm. But that's actually one of the bigger difficulties is I have documents and then you lock them up in your safety deposit box. So that's a bad place to put these documents.
Right.
Or nobody knows where they're at. Right. And so your family members need to know where your documents are. You need to know where your documents are. If you don't know where your documents are, then they haven't been reviewed. Let's get that taken care of. They're already too old if you can't find them. Letting the people who are going to help you, they should know where your documents are so that they can get them in a pinch. But yes, they're important documents.
Okay, moving on to the next most common question. What does a trust do? Is it just for the rich?
Right. And so we talked about bringing your children on to assist you and make it easy, quote unquote. Make it that if you needed their help, that they would already be on an account. Or do we do estate planning to make sure that there's a smooth transition should you need assistance during your lifetime or should you die? Now, for me, and by the way, you can find other attorneys out in the marketplace that have a different viewpoint on this topic. And I'm not going to say they're wrong and I'm right, or I'm wrong and they're right. Most of the time, if I just look at myself in the mirror, I can argue with myself because I'm an attorney. So put two of us in the same room and now we're going to have complete disagreement. For me, and the way that I move my practice is that I utilize revocable living trusts as a primary tool in estate planning. Yes, we can do wills, but I just believe that there's additional benefits that a trust provide individuals that cannot, that can just never be done in a will. So if the main objective is just to avoid probate, we talked in previous shows that actually a will drives you towards the probate process. Mm. So if you want a more secure way to avoid probate, you should be using a revocable living trust. So let's break down those terminologies. Revocable, that means you have full power and control. You can change the document at any time. So one of your kids has another child and we want to add into the list of grandchildren. No problem. You have full control over that document. You can make an amendment. You can change the document. You're fully in control, which also means that the assets that are in a revocable living trust are under your full and absolute control, to such control that we still use your social security number on those assets. So an important thing about a revocable living trust is that it provides no asset protection for you as the creator. If you're in a car accident, your insurance is going to cover you, not your trust. If you are in a health emergency and spending all of your money, a revocable living trust is not a Medicaid trust. They are very different creatures. They serve very different purposes. So you will need to use your finances in a revocable living trust, even if you have a health emergency. So not all trusts are created equally because they are created for different purposes. We need to understand what is your purpose. What are you trying to, what is your objective that you're trying to actually get to? So we have to talk through what are your goals and what are your visions to create the right type of trust. Now, so a revocable means you're in full power and control. Living means we can put living instructions in there. Guide the successor trustee, the person who takes over the assets and manages the trust, should you not be able to do it because you have a health emergency. We give them clear instructions. I want to give clear instructions because it does two major things. Number one, it really gives that person security that they're utilizing your money in a way that you've designed and in a way that you've told them. So it gives them security to use your money properly. And then number two is that it gives them a shield and a cover, because if they are using your money in a way that it was instructed, revocable living, the living instructions, then if one of the other children, siblings, say, hey, you're not doing this properly, you're not utilizing mom and dad's money correctly, they can turn the document around and it becomes a defense to them. And it says, really, look at the instructions. Mom and dad left me really good instructions on how they want their money to be utilized should this time come upon them. So not only does it give security to the successor trustee, setting up a very smooth transition, but it can give them legal protection, because you don't want to put someone in a position to where they're assisting you and then put them in a legal pickle to where they have a bullseye on their back from other people accusing them of doing wrong. Now, if they're doing wrong, they should have a bullseye on their back, right? So if they're stealing money, then the trust actually gives protection to the beneficiaries. But when the successor trustee is doing well, when they're following the rules, when they're doing what they're supposed to, it gives them cover. And so therefore, it does multiple things as far as instructions and protection to the successor trustee. And this is what we want. We want to make sure that there's rich instructions so that they can do exactly what you want to do. And by the way, that's what it means to do good estate planning. Your voice speaking into a circumstance when you have maybe have lost control. So I tell clients, when we do good estate planning, you will have more control at the end of the day than what you have walking into doing the estate planning. Why? Because we have covered the time that if you lose control, we've used your voice to give you back control because we're giving in good instructions to the one who is going to assist you. So that is control during a time when you may be losing it. So utilizing your voice is critical in this process. And then a revocable living trust has tax benefits that a will simply cannot do. A will in its simplistic form is a check writing instrument. It gets money to the right people, just like a beneficiary designation asset does, just like a TOD does, a transfer on death. It puts money in somebody's hands, but it can't accomplish tax objectives. And it certainly cannot protect the beneficiary from themselves, from a walking away spouse, if they're in a car accident or other life scenarios that we hope never happen. But yet, we know that we live in a fallen world. We know that we live in a world that produces difficulties and trials. And so let's make our estate plan be ready for those instances. I can use a revocable living trust and prepare my beneficiaries in a protected entity and set them up for better success, both tax-wise and protection-wise. So for my firm, I typically utilize a revocable living trust. I can protect my client, and then I can protect the next generation. And so let's get together. Let's talk about this.
People are intrigued. They've heard some common questions, and they want more answers from you. Paul, how do people find out more?
Yeah, head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, and ways to communicate with us. We'd love to meet you. Head over to legacyandfaith.com.
Okay, some of the heart of Paul Grand, estate and tax planning attorney, and the Legacy and Faith Show here on KCIS.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.